Good morning. I am Chris, and I am an alcoholic. And thank you for having me to Springville. It's a place that I have spent time before, and it is a lovely place. I love the outdoors, and so to have a little bit of gray and the sunshine and all, I just soak it in because I absolutely do love it, and you do have a great town. And I want to thank you to Darcy. We tried to connect a little bit before my coming up here, and we played, you know, the telephone tag game, but at least we got to leave messages for one another and finally meet. And we had a lovely potluck last night, and some of you were able to be there, and it was really nice. It was very heartwarming for me to be welcome somewhere like that. I get teary-eyed. I can't help it. I'm sorry. I have a heart that is full of gratitude today, and I understand that my tears a lot of times. Sometimes I'm nervous. I'll tell you that. I'm nervous. I get nervous before I talk because you will judge me, and I know that, and that's okay. But I have a heart that's very full of gratitude today for the life that I get to lead today, to come and do things like this, and to meet new people and new friends, and to travel, you know, all kinds of places. And just be able to reach my hand out today and to look people in the eye and to get to meet you and to know you and take that back home with me. And it's not just, you know, something that, who was that? Where did I go? You know, it's truly, it's a rich experience that my heart gets to carry. So I thank you for that. And I got to spend a few nights up here, which was really wonderful for me because I do love the outdoors. And I was looking forward to some nice walks in the woods, and we got to I got to hike up to the surge tank the other day, and Jan took me on two great beautiful walks, and it was just what I really needed right now. And breathe in the outdoors and all the smells that come out when it started to rain, and you know, those are moments that I live for these days. And you know, it was just all a blur to me at one time in my life. It was just a blur, and it didn't have any meaning to it. And I think that's why I do get this, you know, these crocodile tears and stuff, because so much of life has so much meaning to me today. And I got this rich full life that I get to go forth and, you know, continue to live, provided that I do the things that I've been taught to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And not just do them because I got to do them, but do them because I want to do them. And I still want this program. I should start by saying I have a sobriety date. It is April 27th, 1984. By the grace of God, I have not had to pick up a drink, you know, in that amount of time. And today I still understand that that has very little to do with me, very little to do with me. It has to do with me and the fact that I still do want to do the things that, you know, provide me the opportunity to stay sober, hopefully till midnight. I understand that I am just, you know, today is the day that I have. It's not that I have, you know, a lot of years put together. I have a lot of days put together, and I don't ever want to forget that I have a lot of days put together, not a lot of years, you know, because I see a lot of people with a lot of years who forget, and they have gone back out. And, you know, it's for some of them it's a struggle to come back in, and for others, thank God, they get to walk back through these doors. So I don't ever want to forget that it's just a lot of days that I have put together. I have a home group. It's the Tuesday night Women's Promises meeting, and I just love that group dearly. We are a very strong group. We're strong in service in our area, and there are people who come in with, you know, just hours sober, days sober, and there are people with a lot of time in that meeting, and there are people of all colors and all, you know, it's just, I love it. That's, you know, that's what I love. It's one of the things I dearly love about Alcoholics Anonymous, that it seems to me we come together and we forget, you know, who each of us really are. We just know that we're, you know, like the book talks about, we're people who are in the sinking ship, we're all in the same boat together now. And what a blessing that is, because throughout the world there is so much judgment and prejudice. And we come in here and we forget all that, you know, whether you're, you know, Hispanic, you're black, you're white, you're creative, you're not creative. It's just, we're all just one happy family here. And we're here for the same purpose, as it was said in our traditions as they were read today. And I have that beautiful home group that I attend every week. I have a panel. I have a sponsor. Her name is Diane D. I check in with her regularly, and I try to meet with her as often as I can. So we have that eye-to-eye FaceTime. That's very important to me, to have that eye-to-eye FaceTime with her, you know. I don't want to be, you know, I want that. I want that contact, you know. And so, you know, we were meeting regularly and doing lunch and or pick her up for a meeting, whatever it takes so that we can have that time together. She's a busy woman. I'm a busy woman, but it's really important to me. And so those are three of the things to me, you know, to have a home group, to have a sponsor, and to have, you know, that sobriety date that are very important to me. And I have ladies that, you know, I have had the privilege and the honor to sponsor today. And it is truly, you know, one of those gifts that I didn't know that I would get here, to see people wake up and come alive and see their lives, you know, start all over again. There's a line in the book, and I absolutely love it. It says that we get to recreate our lives here. And it was like, wow, when that, you know, when that first hit me, I don't even know when it was, but that I get to recreate my life here. It's like, what a gift that has been given to me, you know, because it's a life that's not being created by King Alcohol and the things that are just happening to me. It's a life that I get to choose those things that are happening in my life and recreate it, literally. And that is truly a gift. Anyhow, I will do as is suggested, and we talk a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today for me in my life. And I am the youngest in my family. I was the baby of the family, and I was the girl that my parents always wanted. I have two other siblings, two older brothers, and I was the girl that finally came along. And I said to my dad one day, and, you know, you never knew what you were praying for was going to be your worst nightmare, did you? And but I have also turned out to be his, you know, the greatest joy. And I give that, you know, that thanks to you guys that I have turned out to be that in my parents' life. And I'm very active in my dad's life right now because he's 82 and he just lost his wife. And he comes with me every Saturday night to an AA meeting. He supported me when I first got sober, and he's my date on Saturday nights, you know. And I tell my husband, sorry, you know, but Dad's really my, you know, he's my hot date, your second fiddle tonight. And what a great gift that is. You know, my dad thinks you guys are absolutely just hot stuff. And he said at my 15-year birthday, he gave me a cake. And he said, you know, in my years, whatever, however old he was at that time, he said, I've seen a lot of great things in my time come about, you know, inventions and all different things that have come about. He said, I have never seen anything like what you people do with the lives of a broken person. He said, it's probably the greatest thing I've ever seen happen. You know, you can't pay a more, you just can't pay a bigger compliment in my book. And that happens around us each and every day. And you guys took a broken girl, you know, and someone who always wanted to be a good daughter. That was part of one of my dreams, just to be a good daughter, you know, suit up and show up and make my parents proud, you know. And alcohol stripped all that away, but you guys brought me back to a place where I am a good daughter today. And that's, you know, one of those things that I couldn't pay back to my parents or to you. I grew up in Redondo Beach. I was born and raised there. And if you've never been there, it's, you know, it is. It's a great town. We have, you know, we have all those little beach communities strung together, Hermosa Beach, Redondo Beach, Manhattan Beach, you know, you can just go up and down either way you want to go. And as far as I'm concerned, it is Mecca for somebody who is, you know, one of us. And because you don't even have to hop in your car, really. You could walk just, you know, Hermosa Beach, and you could just hit bar after bar after bar. And, you know, and if you lived at the beach, it was even better. I did that for a while, you know, and then you just walk back to your house, and so you don't have to worry about, you know, getting pulled over for drunk driving on the way home. But it was truly Mecca for, you know, a little budding flower like myself when I was first starting to drink and, you know, out on my own. I will back up and just tell you that I know that at a very early age, I felt like there was a wild child just waiting to break out, you know. I went to Catholic school. My parents did everything they could for us kids to make sure we just had, you know, a good life. I don't come from a rich family. I don't come from a poor family, just a very middle-class family. My parents enrolled us in things such as, you know, music lessons, dance lessons, scouts, all the good things that, you know, were to make the character of this person, you know, that I am today just be, you know, a good kid going out there. And I know looking back at, you know, like scouts, it was just like we'd go in and we'd make these Indian eyes and all this, you know, funky stuff, and I'm thinking, this is just like hokey. Isn't there something, you know? I mean, really, isn't there something more than this? You know, I just thought it was kind of goofy, and it was like I was always looking for something else. I had my little vest with, you know, you had these little patches that you sewed on for things that you did. And I'd go to walk home because the meeting was not very far from my house, and I think I'm wrapping this thing up and stuffing it in my pocket because, you know, I didn't have that sense of pride that a lot of people had in, you know, what it was just like, where's the boys? Where's, you know, where's something fun happening? Where's something exciting happening? And it just didn't do it. So I look back after coming into Alcoholics Anonymous and we go back and we reexamine, you know, those things in our life and what makes us who we are. And I look at some of that stuff and go, you know, for many other people, that was very normal. For me, you know, to go and do those things, and they were proud of wearing that little vest, and they, you know, brought home the little, you know, Indian eye thing, and, you know, they were like, ooh, look what I did, you know, and I'm thinking it's just, okay, I know there's something different. I started smoking cigarettes in third grade. I remember very vividly, still to this day, smoking my first cigarettes. My parents both smoked, and I took a cigarette, and I went back out in my backyard and had one of those banana, what they used to call a banana lounge chair, and I folded that thing down. I started to puff with that cigarette kind of secretly, and I got very dizzy, and I got very sick to my stomach. And I went, ooh, that's kind of cool. You know, instead of going, ooh, yuck, and hacking, and, you know, I'm thinking that's kind of cool. And I smoked from that time forward. My mom caught me stealing cigarettes at the Alphabet on 190th Street when I was in fourth grade, you know, stealing my first pack of cigarettes. And here I am, this little girl who goes to Catholic school up the street that, you know, my parents are shelling out good tuition for, and they just want the best for this little kid, you know. And my mom did the thing that I would do, you know, to my child and said, you know, that is the manager of the store right there, and you can go up and you can show him what you have in your pocket, and you can give them back to him, and you can ask him, you know, is there anything you can do to, you know, pay him back for the act that you just committed? I'm like, I didn't even know she'd seen me, you know, and Joni knew my mom, and so I had to go do that. But I look back at that, too, and I go, that was, you know, sure, it, like, scared the bahooty out of me, you know, to have to go and do that and to get caught, you know, and that adrenaline rush and everything. Did it stop me from those kind of things? Absolutely not. And I look at, you know, throughout my, you know, my drinking, it was like consequences just became a thing that were going to happen. You know, they didn't become a thing that scared me. They were just, you know, you might have consequences. Oh, well, you know, oh, well. And, I'm going to do it anyways because I'm going to have fun. So I look at where I was, you know, at that early time, and I went into public school in sixth grade. I got to ask my dad that question, why they ended up doing that. Maybe they just figured I wasn't going to make it in Catholic school. I don't know. But I went into public school in sixth grade, and there were kids doing things that I hadn't really heard of, you know, in my little wonderful Catholic school group. And it was that little wild child thing that I found, you know, that other people doing funny things, that it was like, this is interesting. And I, having that personality already, was adventuresome enough to try it. Scared to death, but adventuresome enough to try it. Some kid wanted to go to my house because he knew I lived close and smoke. We could, I think, put them in the oven, banana peels, and then you smoke them. And I'm like, really? You know? And I'm scared to death because my mom works not very far. What if she comes home and, you know, willing to try it, you know, let's go. And so we did it, you know, more on a dare than anything. It's like, all right, you know, I kind of want to fit in, I'll take the dare, you know. That adrenaline stuff is going on back at that very early age. Needless to say, that's just how it started to go for me. By the time I was in seventh grade, was where I started to drink and to have fun drinking. We had seventh and eighth grade dances. We're big kids now, and you bought a ticket at the front door. And we bought the ticket, and we went in, and we spent 20 minutes in there. We'd already figured out the exit plan. We already had the stuff stashed in the bushes outside, and we were back out the door. You know, we were going to have some, you know, what we considered to be the real fun of the evening. The Annie Green Springs, the Boone's Farm wine, all that stuff, the Spinata. Oh, that is nasty to get sick on, Spinata. Nasty stuff to get sick on. But we had a mutual friend. Her name was Diane, and I started, you know, palling around with some of these gals, and not by any means was it any of their faults, you know. I was the one ready to have that kind of fun. And we'd figure out who could buy it for us, and you get the whole plan going, you know, and everybody chips in their money. We asked that guy over there. We had another friend, her name was Nina, and Nina's mom was cool, and she'd pick us up a bottle of wine and stuff. She figured, girls aren't going to get in too much trouble, and she'd let us drink at her house. And you know, those were the kind of people that I found to end up, you know, starting to create that little circle of friends that I felt comfortable with, you know, that I felt comfortable with. And that's the kind of stuff that we did. And I can't tell you that I look back and at any point in time, because I heard a lot of people when I first came to the program talking about how they filled the hole in the gut at that time, or they drank to feel so that they could feel as though they fit in. I did not necessarily identify with that, because I can go someplace and fortunate. I look back and I thank my dad for this because we traveled a lot when I was young. And my dad was always a man who could go up, you know, be in these little small towns and talk to people and reach his hand out and start asking questions. He was just an example for that for me. So I've never found that kind of hard to do. I felt like I could fit in almost anywhere that I went. I didn't need the drink to do that. But I did find just this, you know, I always call it the wild child, you know, blossomed when I started to drink. And I had fun with it. I just had a lot of fun behind it. Yes, there did come the day where I can tell you that I started to pick up drinks to not feel the guilt, not feel the shame, not be able to look you in the eye because I know I'd ripped you off or told you a lie or something, you know. That's where I can tell you that I started to drink to get rid of, you know, feelings and how I felt about myself. But not to feel like I had to fit into, you know, to have fun or anything. I was just purely having fun, and I had a lot of fun with it. What I didn't know is what the book finally explained to me is that I have that disease, you know, that I take one and I am off to the races because it sets up something different within me than it set up in a lot of the people that I partied with, that it sets up differently than people I see today, you know, people who can drink normally, who can have a cocktail and, you know, go home and finish their housework and put the kids to bed, you know, and get up and go, you know, do life again tomorrow morning. And I never had a cocktail, you know. It was, it was always many cocktails. And anyhow, so here I am, you know, 7th and 8th grade, and I'm just having fun with this stuff. And somewhere in that period, I got to tell you that I knew when I went into high school that I as a person had changed. And something equated it to it was what I was doing in the lifestyle that I was already living at that, you know, at that early age. And so I made up my mind somewhere in there that when I got into high school, I'm going to buckle down and I'm really going to do good. My oldest brother was 7 years older than I, and I remember him, my mom and my grandma, going to his baccalaureate, which I still don't know what it is because I didn't go either, but going to his baccalaureate, which is like the day or 2 days before graduation, and coming home, and they're both in tears because my brother did not show up. My brother was one of us, and, you know, and I don't know what he was doing. He was probably off surfing and smoking dope somewhere, you know, and the baccalaureate just, whoops, missed it. And my parents came, my mom and my grandma came home, and they were just in tears, and I swore at that time, I will never do that to them. She was just heartbroken, absolutely heartbroken. But, I ended up doing just those same kind of things. And I knew in my mind, like I said, when I entered my freshman year, it's like, okay, I'm going to buckle down. I'm really going to, you know, I'm going to do good. And I went in. I have learned in here, I'm really not dumb. Most of us aren't. You know, we just got a little clouded out there behind the things that we were doing and couldn't apply ourselves as, you know, for the potential that we really do have. And so I got on these college prep, you know, whatever, and I had, you know, I'd already had 2 years of Spanish, and I went into algebra, and, you know, the things that, you know, you're going to go on, you're going to go to college, and one of my dreams, too, to go on and get an education and do those kind of things. And I got in there, and it was very, I was probably in my, you know, in my sophomore year that some of that stuff, it's like I started switching classes, because, you know what? It's hard to go into class after you smoked a joint in the parking lot and, you know, go in and really pay attention to what's going on in class. You know, all those commercials that they used to have, this is your brain on drugs, you know, we'd all laugh, you know, and whatever. And you know what, that was my brain on drugs. I hate to tell you, but, you know, that was my brain on drugs. And so, you know, that thing, you know, that here's one of my hopes and my dreams to do good in school, to make my parents proud. To go off and, you know, end up with, I don't know what. Really, the only career I ever wanted was to be a mom. But I knew that I'd go to school and do college well and all that kind of stuff. And here's a hope and a dream that gradually, you know, just starts to slip away and didn't even notice, you know. Or if I did, it was like by that time, I'm so already, this disease has me, you know, and I don't know that something has me already. You know, it's described that we have a mental obsession. And I can look back and think about sitting in a classroom where my junior high school was and sitting in a classroom and Prospect Avenue went by and we had had, you know, the dance or a party or who knows what on that weekend and it may be Wednesday and my mind is not paying attention to the teacher's Spanish lesson. My mind is thinking, thank you very much, I wonder what's happening on Friday. I wonder what's going to go on Saturday. How are we going to get, where are we going to get, who's going to get? That, my friends, I've come to understand is the mental obsession. You know, and when I get to look back and do the work that is suggested of me here, those things, you know, pop up right in front of me. It's like, oh my God, you know, seventh grade, here I was already, you know, with this disease staring me, you know, staring me in the face. And I had not a clue. So I went in, you know, through high school a little bit more, and that's where I met, you know, my dear friend Joan, who lives up here with you guys. And all along, we lived like a couple blocks away from each other. But once our schools all merged, I went to a different junior high. And, you know, here I meet all these other people who like to do a lot of the stuff that I like to do. But drinking was part of everything I did at this point, even, you know, in high school. And so, you know, one by one, I got on the swim team. That was another thing that I was proud of. You know, I was a good swimmer. You know, I had broken one of the records for the school in backstrokes, and, you know, I was proud of that. And it was like, wow, this is really kind of cool. The first time I'd ever done, like, a team sport, so to speak, where you're representing something or someone. And pretty soon, I'm not showing up for practices, you know, and the coach is talking to you and going, you know, you have to show up for these things. That's what this is all about. We do this together as a team. You represent your school. You know what? And pretty soon I'm not even thinking about that. And it's just something that I came to love and something that I, you know, let go. Why did I let it go? Because the disease already had me, and I have no idea of that. You know, it's already got me. And so I let that go as well. And somewhere, I don't know if it was in actually my senior year or my junior year, but I ended up in the remedial, you know, courses of school. And it's where they give you a book and they tell you, you really need to get through the next four chapters in about the next 4 months, you know. I mean, it's like, and, you know, there's somebody there to kind of guide you and, you know, and whatever. So here's this girl who wants to make her parents proud, who wants to do good herself, you know, and all this stuff is slipping away. In the meantime, I am becoming a fabulous con artist along the way. I think we all become, you know, we are masters of the game. You know, I think we could pull off some of the world's best heists with our personalities, our creative minds, you know, I really do. And my parents, I really don't think they had much of a clue what was going on in my life. And they were the kind of parents, it's like, you're staying at Joni's house, I'm going to call. I want to talk to her mom and dad. I want to know who they are, where they live, you know, blah, blah, blah. I hated that crap. It was just like, I hated it, you know. And I used to just think, God, you know, you don't trust me or, you know, whatever. And, well, yeah, of course not. You know, they were always checking out. And they were good, you know, parents with that kind of stuff. I always want to give my parents credit because they were very good parents, you know, and they did want the best for me, and they did check up on me. But I became a master at the game. You know, I tell you, this is where we were going. We already had the plot, you know, in place and the story written, and we'd end up at somebody else's house, and I'd have the different clothes in the bag in, you know, so-and-so's trunk so I could look hot that night instead of just, you know, like my parents wanted me to look and, you know, all that stuff. And go have the fun that I wanted to have, you know. And I went and had the fun that I wanted to have. And so, you know, already, okay, here I am becoming the liar, the cheat, the thief. I probably stole, you know, money out of my mom's purse that night to, you know, be able to buy the booze or the drugs. And that was the person that I was becoming, the person behind this disease. I, throughout high school, you know, I wrote all my own notes. You know, I think I probably wrote the second note that ever went to high school. You know, they'd be just, you know, Chris is gone again. Chris, today they have this, like, automatic check-in thing. And it's, you are screwed if you're a kid in high school today, because in our area, anyways, it's like this automatic thing, and almost like a computer system rings your house. Your child is not in school today. You know, it's like, I'd be hosed. So I get, you know, to my senior year, and the heat is on, because I am not going to graduate, and I am going to disappoint my parents in that same way as I saw happen with my brother. And so I did the next best thing, and I ran away from home. And I packed everything that I thought was of real importance to me into half a dozen big black hefty bags, you know. You don't need much. I'm out to just have fun now, you know. And I move 3 blocks away from my parents' house, you know. My dad was just a very good man, a great mechanic, and my dad had bought me a little Volkswagen Squareback, and I thought, you know, well, I'll leave the car, you know, don't ask, I don't know. and left the car, and I left two notes, one for my dad, one for my mom, you know, here's what's going on, I can't live here anymore, blah, 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 you know, I'll be in touch, you know, breaking my parents' hearts. Here's this little child that they, you know, just, my dad said to me the other day, he goes, you know, I got to let you know, you were not like a mistake or anything. You were wanted so desperately. And I said, yeah, and I ended up with a wanted poster, you know, my picture and stuff, and he just laughed, you know. But so I moved this three blocks away, and I think I'm in heaven, you know. I'm not 18 yet. I got a car from somebody to use. I drove downtown. This gal, Vicky, got me a job at some insurance company downtown. I used to drive downtown, and I was a filing clerk, and I had a paycheck coming in. And how I lied about my age and got away with that, I don't know. But I had a paycheck coming in, so now I could do what I want, when I want, with who I want, how long I want, where I want. Doesn't that sound like a good plan for an alcoholic? It was Mecca again. And so I am off to the races. And I love to camp. I got into snow skiing. I got into water skiing. Mexico became a place that I love to go. Who songs, drink tequila, you know, just have tons of fun. And I'm an adventuresome spirit already. My dad worked for Transworld Airlines for his entire career. And we traveled. My dad said, you guys will see the States when you're older. He said, we're going to hit every place we can as you're growing up overseas. And we did. And so I have this adventuresome spirit as well, you know. And if you say, do you want to go, you don't even have to say where it is. And I'm already saying yes. Because, you know, let's hop in the car, let's go. But every place I went, you know, you had to have the requirements. What were the first things on the list, usually? You know, the booze. The booze has to come first. You know, the secrets box packed with, you know, or whatever, an Altoids container, whatever, with all the dope already rolled and stashed in there. And, you know, we're off. Okay, we can have a good trip. A few clothes and, you know, throw it in the back of the car and we're gone. And I had so much fun out there for so long, you know. But everything evolved around drinking. Everything did. And I have no idea that I've got this disease. But once you're out there and you're trying to make it on your own and do these things, and you got to pay bills, and, oh, crap, I'm late on rent. You know, well, why are you late on rent? There was a concert. I'm sorry. I bought concert tickets, you know. I could name you the things. Somebody said, let's go to Mexico. I went to Mexico. I'll have the rent next week, you know. And so, it was one more time, these things that I had learned as a child by the example of my parents, to be on time with bills, to pay rent, to do those things, to be just a good, responsible citizen, I didn't give any of it a thought. And I never gave a thought that, you know what, I was really doing you a disservice or screwing you or making your life tough because I didn't have the rent money. Now you got to come up with it out of your pocket. None of that stuff ever even occurred to me. You know, the people I was hurting along the way. You know, we ruined a lot of lives along. I ruined a lot of lives, you know, along the way of people that had to make up for my crap, whether it had been in a job that I couldn't function very well at. And so you're cleaning up behind me to, you know, to get my job done. You know, probably a budding Alan on there. But, you know, it was just, I never gave any of that a thought. And by the time that I hit 25, man, I was fried. I had just been through people. I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and I absolutely respect that this is Alcoholics Anonymous and the singleness of purpose, but I got into, you know, a lot of other things. I started smoking PCP when I was like 17 years old, and to this day, I thank God that I'm still here, because that became my biggest drug of choice, you know, and I lived and died for it, you know, lived and died for smoking PCP, and I was just basket case, man. And then, you know, along the way, I met some wild girl. I always met these wild people. I'm in sixth grade. Here's one of the reasons that, you know, there was this girl. Her nickname was Dumpy. This would give you a clue. Probably not a good person to hang around with, you know. Her dad rode with who's a motorcycle guy, an easy rider. Her dad rode motorcycles with him. Her mom was just this hippie chick, you know. She was kind of a hippie chick. And they didn't really care what you did, you know, at their house or whatever. And she told a story about dropping acid and running naked down the street. I found that extremely exciting, you know. Here she is, sixth grade. I'm thinking, that is, wow, you know. That's the kind of stuff that I was, like, attracted to. And so, you know, later on in this life here, I meet this girl, Karen, who, you know, goes overseas to Japan or China or somewhere, and she's some kind of nude dancer over there, and, you know, and she brings back this idea of smoking cocaine, you know. I'm instantly attracted to this woman. And, you know, and so I go down this path with all this other stuff, and it just became one more thing to add fuel to the fire, you know. And I'm grateful, actually, today for those things, because I think, personally for me, and maybe not, I don't truly know, had I just been the drinker, I don't know that I would be here yet. You know, they were just things that are part of my story that today I know that other people do identify with, and they will come up and they will talk to me afterwards because they're the one who was the secret PCP smoker, never told anybody, you know. And it's like, so today I do share that because I really, you know, I know a couple of those people who were locked up in institutions. I know, you know, our friend Greg, who he's not here anymore, you know, because he just fried his brain too bad behind doing that kind of stuff. And I don't know why I am here other than what the, you know, the book talks about is we are here to show up for one another and hopefully help one other person recover from this disease, you know, and know that there is life afterwards and to, you know, to share that message and help them on this path. And so I just give thanks to God that, you know, thanks for sparing me because, you know, that's what I try to do here. So at 25 years old, here I am. I can't hold a job. I don't even know how many jobs I have been through at this point in time because I can't show up long enough for you. You know, I hear the party's happening and I'm gone. I hear somebody's going somewhere and I'm gone, you know. And so it's one more Monday I'm calling in and Monday turns into Tuesday. And you know, then you're so ashamed and guilty. It's like, oh, God, you know. I had a couple jobs I just never went back to. It's just like, you know, why even go back to them? I had one. I worked at this little place, and I have no recollection of working at this place. The only thing, my mom got this card in the mail, and it was for, they were having a sale at this leather warehouse. And I went to this leather warehouse, and they had a little field to sign in so you could get on next year's mailing list. And here they have the stationery underneath this glass on this desk, and I'm going, Columbia Imports, I worked here once. You know, I don't know if it was for 2 days, 2 weeks, 2 months. I have absolutely no clue whatsoever. And I'm sure I had other jobs like that. I don't know. Anyways, at 25 then, here I am, and I'm working at an aerospace company because I am creative enough at this point in time that I wrote a very good letter of recommendation for myself. I have a very good resume put together at this point in time, and I can tell a very good story. So I got my way into this company, and I'm still with that company today, you know, all these years later. And I know that it was the grace of God, one more time, that I passed the probationary period before they checked on some of that stuff. And I still remember the man's name from where I worked at Xerox, and I signed his name to the bottom of that letter, Mr. Faulkner. And the lady called me in from Human Resources, and she said, well, you have passed your probationary period, she said, but I really kind of have a question about this letter of recommendation because I did call and check up with Mr. Faulkner. He doesn't quite agree with everything that's in here, you know. And I did what I had become so accustomed to do. You know, he and I left on very bad terms, and there was something that happened right at the very end, blah, 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 you know, lie, 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 lie. And one more time, you know, BS my way into this place. But I know, I kind of think of God every now and then. If everybody knows what a marionette show is where they have the puppets on the, you know, I think of God as, you know, just like the master puppeteer, you know. And God knew where I was supposed to be, when I was supposed to be, you know, all that good stuff. And here I am at this job, and that just didn't happen until after I passed my probationary period. And so I stayed there. And it was just a few months before I got, I got sober in October, and I went into that, I started in April, and I originally got sober in October. When I got sober, I went to a recovery, at that time, a hospital program. I was 25, 26 years old, and I am hitting the bottom. I am leaving work, going, you know, every day at lunch, just waiting for the, you know, the clock to count down so I can get out of there. I hear the ladies who are going off, and they're going to have lunch over here, and they're going to do this, and they're going to whatever, and I so want to be a part of that, but I can't, because I have the secret life that I live now, and I'm dashing off to the dope man's house and stopping at the liquor store, you know, and doing what I need to do at lunch and coming back to this fine establishment trying to work, you know, after a lunch like that. And that was my lunch probably every day of the week, you know, going off and doing that. Just hating myself because that's what I have to do and I can't join in with you and live a normal life. I can't tell you what I'm doing, even though, you know, these people had a good idea. I'm stealing from the coffee pool when I don't have enough money to go buy what I need to go buy, you know, and just this is you know, this young woman that my parents had raised to be this decent, good, you know, individual, and I have just become scum, you know, and that's how I thought of myself at that, you know, at that early age. And so I called the girl who I had talked to one day, and I said, you know, when I talked to her, of course, it was about a friend who may need help one day. And I called her, and I said, Mickey, I said, you know, I need that number to that employee assistance program. I said, you know, I'm that person that I talked to you about. And she said, I kind of had a feeling. And she gave me the number to the employee assistance program. And I called this number, and the woman that answered the phone was at our corporate office. And she said, honey, she said, we don't have anybody there today. She said, but, you know, if you give me a call back tomorrow. And I was at that point. We had been on a trip out to Palm Springs, just Jones High School, just right before that. And the city of Palm Springs, I think the police department and the hotel really kind of said to us, you know, we'd rather you never came back to our city again. You know, somehow we ended up with these motorcycle guys, and there was motorcycles parked in the hotel room, and, you know, it was just, oh my, it was just, how did we, you know, and you know what, I love the line in the book. It says, you know, and the alcoholic life seems the only normal one. You know, that seemed normal to me. It was just like, this is what it had become. But there was also a part of me like, you know, this isn't normal. You know, and that weekend, for whatever reason, was really kind of a, you got to get some help, man. And so that was right shortly after when I went to work and called these people. And I told this lady, I said, you obviously don't understand. I said, I don't think I can leave work tonight. I'm afraid that I may not make it. And I was at that point that I just didn't think that I would live another day out there doing this stuff. And it's that thing that we hear people say in here that, you know, had I died, the wrong person would have died that day. And we've all seen that happen to many, many people. You know, the wrong guy would have died. We had a friend, Joe, who died up here, and, you know, got nailed by a logging truck. You know, he came up here to get sober, and he just couldn't do it, and he was drunk, and he got nailed by a logging truck. You know, the wrong guy died that day. Joe was just a really decent, you know, human being. And so the lady heard the desperation in my voice. And she said, honey, you just stay right there. We'll call you back in a few minutes. And she got a hold of the guy, Frank H., who came in and opened up his office for me. And I went into his office, you know, and I just spilled my guts. And I'm like, Frank, this is what's going on. You know, I'm drinking and we're smoking all this PCP. And we just got thrown out of Palm Springs. And my life's just a wreck. And I can't look anybody, you know, and I'm just like dumping everything. And I'm stealing license plate tags from people, you know, I'm putting them on my own car because I can't register my car and I got so many tickets I'm going to go to jail, and you know, and I'm just like spilling my guts to this man. And he finally said, honey, he said, I understand where you are. Let me tell you something about myself. And he told me just, he did, you know, he did the deal where one alcoholic talks to another alcoholic. And he shared a little bit about his life. And he was sober about 18 years at that time. And I knew he was the first person that I had really talked to eye to eye, face to face, that he knew where I had been, because he had been there too. And that's the miracle of this program, is, you know, talking one-on-one to another person. We don't judge you, we don't whatever, we just tell you there's a way out. And that's exactly what he told me. He said, you know, I have a program that I attend, and he said, you can have it too. And he said, I don't have to live that way of life anymore, one day at a time. And he got my attention, you know. He said, are you willing to go into a hospital program? He made some phone calls, and I said, absolutely, yes. And so I went into a hospital program. They made the calls. I went back to my desk, and everything was just taken care of. And you know, I got to walk out the door that day. I still have that paperwork. I keep it at my desk. Every now and then I look at it because it means a lot to me. You know, I keep in touch with that man as often as I can because he was my Eskimo that day. And so I got to check into this hospital program. I will let you know that I went to the hospital program first to check it out on Saturday to make sure it met my standards. I saw my mom in a locked ward, and there was something about that just, I'm not going to the locked ward kind of thing. And so I went, and there was a handsome man who ran this program. He was never there on Saturdays, but he happened to be there on that particular Saturday, and I, you know, part of my mind went, you know, there's Mr. Destiny. And here I am, I have no bottom teeth because of my last car crash. You know, I'm like, a size 10 clothes, you know, so I turn sideways, you know, I'm like this piece of paper, and thinking I am looking hot. And so I check into this hospital program. When I went the following Monday, I will let you know I brought bathing suits. I brought books to read because they had a beautiful little patio. I like the sun. I figured that would work well for me. And I had no idea what I was getting into. I knew that the drugs had to stop. There was something inside in the back of my head that, you know, I wasn't so sure about the drinking, but all the other stuff had to. I checked myself in this hospital, and I really did truly want to change my life. Joni reminded me the other night that while I was in that hospital, I did call her to ask her, can you bring me some dope, man? You know, and here I am. I want to be in there. But that's, you know, I know that that's our disease, you know. And it just, it takes a while to clear it out. And I remember being honest with the counselors there going, I don't know if I really want to quit drinking. I mean, I can't imagine going to Hoosongs or to Mexico and not stopping in Hoosongs. You know, looking this woman straight in the eye, I can't imagine getting married and not toasting. You know, I can't imagine going to Mammoth and skiing and not having a flask. And she's like, you know, then maybe you're not ready. But I ended up staying there, you know, and I stayed 35 days. And I got, I did my very first pass that they let me out. I did get high. And I came back, and the director had enough sense in him to put, they had a lockdown ward there. And anybody who had that experience that I did on their first pass, they went into the mental ward for a couple days. And he said, you know, because you must absolutely be out of your mind to have done what you did after having 3 weeks clean and sober. He said, so, you know, here you are. And that's what I went and did. And it was it was very eye-opening. I have a lot of compassion for people who have, you know, I never say anything about anybody who's got to take, you know, any kind of other substance. That's between you and your doctor. You know, and there are a lot of people who will never recover to the state of mind that I have been able to recover, you know, to with the help of the steps, the program, the big book, my sponsor, because they have mental illnesses and they will never know the freedom that I know today. You know, so lest I judge. After that, you know, I kind of went on my merry way and went out, and they introduced us to the idea of sponsorship in that program. They gave us what they called a guide. And that person was to try to help us find meetings in our areas, you know, just get us, you know, firmly planted, you know, here. And I think that was a very good thing that they introduced us to. The big book, the 12 and 12, we had a 24-hour a day book, and it was just thoroughly just immersed in Alcoholics Anonymous in this program. I am forever grateful to those people for that. It gave me, you know, I mean, it just gave me everything I needed just in that first 35 days to really get out there and get going. And I did end up getting a sponsor sometime after, you know, that, a real sponsor, you know, not just my guide, and getting a sponsor. And she started to take me through the book. And that is one of the most magical things that I think we can do with another human being is, you know, to get them into the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not just to say, send you off and tell you, you know, you go read this and come back and let's talk about it. Make sure they've read it, you know, sit and read it together with them. And that's what this woman did for me. You know, I had her a very short time. It was just, I was working two jobs and, you know, but I have always been with a sponsor. My sponsor that I have now, I'm sure I've been with her at least 15 years, you know. And to have another human being that I can share my life with is just an awesome, awesome thing, you know, that I trust, that it's not going anywhere. You know, that is a valuable gift that we are given. That is just to be that kind of trustworthy with another human being's life and story, and it doesn't go anywhere, you know, else. But, you know, that's where I was introduced to the steps and to getting into the big book and starting to do the stuff that really we recover behind, because it is about recovery here. If I were to come here and be the same old person, I don't think I'd still want to be here. I think I would end up miserable. I see people who are miserable in Alcoholics Anonymous. They're just miserable because they don't get in here and do the work to clean up and find out who they are really and clean up the wreckage of their past and do that thing, you know, that recreate your life. And get free of that stuff. I loved meetings right off the bat. You know, I just loved them right off the bat. And I was told, you know, you get there early, you help to set up, you help to clean up, you know, whatever it is that you can do, you reach your hand out and you try to be a service. Service is a very big part of my, you know, sobriety today. I always kind of think you're safe with service, you know, because it puts me in the thick of things. It's like somebody said one time, it's like being in, you know, an old-fashioned, you know, wagon, horse-drawn wagon, how they bump and, you know, whatever. You're sitting on the outside of that wagon, you know, your ass may get tossed right out of here. You know, get in the center of that wagon and get yourself firmly planted. You know, and that's what I believe today, you know, too. I have to stay, 22 years later, firmly in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, because I still... You know, my mind is my mind. My mind is out to get me. It is not my friend. I can tell you that very much so. So I got right into service. I got right into reading, you know, the book. Okay, I changed sponsors, and she wanted me to do the fourth step after we finished the third step. It's like, you know, picking up the 40-pound pencil and start to write this stuff and you know, get through this thing. And it was just like... this person didn't give me a lot of direction. She wasn't firmly planted, but it was the best I did at that time and the best that she could do, you know, and I did the biography at that time. And we finally, you know, when she said to me, Chris, here is the day it will be done, because she saw I was a seventh inning ball player. You know, she saw that right off the bat. She's going to play the game through seven innings and she's gone, you know. She said, you know, here's the day it's going to be done by, and this is, you know, the time you're to be at my house and you're going to read this. And that was the greatest thing she did for me in that, because it set me a date to be finished by. You know, went off and I did that stuff. And I had heard this guy who came to speak at one of our meetings, and he said, you start by putting down your deepest, darkest secret first. And he was just beating on this blackboard doing that, you know. And so I was like, okay, you know. So I put down my deepest, darkest secret, so they were out on the table to this person, you know. And the thing that happened to me after that was that I finally finished something. I finally accomplished something. I didn't feel so free from the stuff that I left, but it was that I finally finished something and accomplished this thing, you know. And I did have stuff that was like, wow, I don't ever have to tell that to anybody again, you know. So the premise of the fourth step was laid there for me. And to go on into the, you know, into the rest of the steps, and she gave me that, you know, she gave me the guidance she knew at the time was 6 and 7, you know, and then into 8. And to make that list. And, you know, to me, my 9th step has been absolutely the most freeing thing that I've been able to do here, to go back to people and to not just apologize for the things that I did, but to me, the making of amends is to go back to you and to tell you, you know, I really do realize what it is that I have done here, you know, and almost to make a pledge that I am not going to do this kind of behavior again, you know, and to ask, what is it that, you know, you would have me do to make this different if you could, you know, and to turn the whole thing around. And what a freedom that is. I've had just some, you know, remarkable experiences with that. I there's so much. I have married, you know, in this program. I met the man that I am married to when I was, that Saturday morning that I was walking into that hospital to go check it out. And him and two friends were leaving the meeting. And I was young and I was scared. And I said, where are you guys coming from? And they're like, we've just come from an AA meeting. And I said, well, I'm really freaked out. I'm thinking of checking into this hospital program. And they stopped and they talked to me. You know, and they told me it's all right, it's a great place, blah, blah, blah. And you know, it wasn't boy meets girl on AA campus and love, you know, follows. It was just, you know, a friendship did start at that point in time. And I ended up marrying one of these men later on, about 2.5 years sober. And that has been a journey in and of itself. My husband has chronic pancreatitis. And for the first 10 years of our, you know, of our married life, he was extremely ill. And he was in the hospital probably 52 times in those 10 years. And, you know, the program of alcoholics has been behind me, with us, on our sides, blanketing us through, you know, through all that kind of stuff. Had a little period of, you know, respite in between there, and then at, you know, just about 7 years ago, it sprang back up again. And you know, he's still afflicted with that today. And it has become a very difficult thing to live with for the both of us, because it's changed our lives completely. And, you know, it changes how you do everything, when you can go, when you can't go, who you can, I mean, it's changed everything. But one more time, I have this program. I have people to reach out to. I do, you know, over the last year and a half, with this becoming so difficult in my life, I've always had a, you know, the 11th step put me into, you know, prayer and meditation. And, you know, that has deepened so much over the years. And now it has come to a point where, you know, I'm up at 5:30 every morning, and I wouldn't miss my writing, my prayer, my reading. It's like food to me. It's like, this is what I have to do to get by, you know, in my day. And it reveals so much about me, you know. And I'm working with another individual right now, the man who helped me get sober, that handsome man, you know, way back when. We've always been friends throughout this, my husband and he and his wife. And one more time, he's got me on, you know, on this, you know, kind of spiritual work and deeper into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know that, you know, whatever is to come, it will be okay, you know, because I have this God of my understanding that is one of our biggest gifts that I've been given here. Ebby introduces that idea to Bill when he comes and sits across the table with him, or when he sees him in the hospital, you know, that first time, and he says, what about coming up with, you know, your own conception of God? You know, and today I have that, and it has grown and it has changed over the times here. And I know, without a shadow of a doubt, that there is almost nothing I can face because I've been through it. I've been through the death of my mother, my brother, this illness, whatever, loss of a job. You know what? I'm going to be okay. I am. Whether I have things or I don't have things, whether, you know, I'm going to be okay. I have you and I have that God of my understanding, and I will be okay. You know, and I have people that, you know, the book tells us when times get hard, what's the best thing we can do? And it's to dive into work with another alcoholic, you know. So I pick up the phone. I listen for who's not feeling well in a meeting or who doesn't seem right, you know. And I get my phone list out and I call and go, you know what, Julie didn't seem like she was doing okay. Just give a call through the week and tell you, you know what, I'm thinking of you. You just didn't look like yourself. You know what, and that gets me out of me just enough, you know, to just change my whole thought pattern. So Alcoholics Anonymous, what can I tell you? It has given me every tool that I have today. It has taught me to be a worker among workers, to continue to be at this job that I am with 23 years later, a valued employee, not just, you know, whatever, not a person who goes into work to seek a paycheck on Friday, but a person who goes into work to, you know, to add something to the company that I go to. You guys taught me how to do that. You guys taught me how to be the daughter that I am today. You know, you guys taught me how to be a friend among friends. You know, I owe everything I have to what I have been given here. And I don't know whether I'll live long enough to pay it all back or not. You know, I could, you know, we don't know when our last day is going to be. You know what? But I want to make sure that, you know, I am giving back on a daily basis so that somebody else catches the gift that you gave me. You know, if you're here on a gift card, I heard a guy, or on a gift card, that's what this guy, that's exactly what this guy said, that's what I was going to say. He said, if you're here on a court card, he said, you better start looking at it as though it's a gift card to Macy's or somewhere, you know, that somebody has given you, because it's a gift card, you know, and it truly is. You know, this is the biggest gift that has ever been given to me, and I hope, you know, that I just get to keep living this beautiful life that I have today. You know, having, you know, fun and traveling, being introduced to new ideas and to new people, and just being open to the things that unfold in front of me, because they unfold in front of me all the time, and I don't have to face them with fear anymore or all those, you know, things that I used to. I just get to go, oh, okay, let's see where that one goes, you know. And so far I've been led down this path that is just absolutely beautiful, and I thank you so much for having me here this weekend.